looks like crime. Ooh, yeah. Ooh. Bible by the month.
It's incredible.
Bible by the month.
So mighty.
Bible by the month.
Fantastic.
Bible by the month.
Uncanny.
Bible by the month.
Johnny, flame on torch.
Hey there. Welcome back to Marvel by the Month, a weekly podcast about the publishing history of Marvel Comics. My name is Brian Stratton.
And my name is Rob Milne.
And this month, we are going to be talking about all of the Marvel Comics that came out with a cover date of April 1963. And that means we're going to be talking about Fantastic Four, number 13, Journey into Mystery, number 91, Strange Tales, number 107, Tales of Suspense, number 40, and Tales to Astonish, number 42. These all hit the newsstands in February of 1963. So let's talk a little bit about what was going on in February 1963.
All right. We have two cool things.
Okay. Tell me about these cool things.
These cool things. Well, one isn't as cool as the other. First, on the 5th of February, we have travel as well as financial and commercial transactions by the United States citizens to Cuba were made illegal by the Kennedy administration.
That's right. So this is all fallout from the Cuban Missile Crisis. This is basically the start of the embargo against Cuba. So I hope if you were an American citizen who wanted to visit Cuba, that you got there before February 5th, 1963, because after that, it got a whole lot harder and you couldn't do any business there, which was really bad news for a lot of travel and hospitality companies, because Cuba used to be a really huge vacation destination for U.S. citizens. But, you know, once they let the Soviets store nukes there that could annihilate Florida.
Dozens of nukes. Yeah.
Yeah. That pretty much put the kibosh on that.
Also, on the 11th of February, we have something near and dear to me as we talk about. It seems like every other episode at this point, the Beatles recorded the 10 songs of their debut album, Please Please Me, in a single 13-hour session at Abbey Road Studios.
I've heard of that band.
Yeah, they're kind of known.
Yeah.
And they really did that. They loaded in, I read something about this just recently, they loaded in at 10 a.m. They were set up by around 11, started recording, and by 10:45 p.m., John Lennon was shirtless and sweaty and screaming his second take of Twist and Shout.
That is wild. Yeah. Yeah, they were straight up rock stars. And his voice was totally blown by that point.
Oh, right? Yeah. But that's also what makes that. I mean, both versions, both takes of that song, his voice is blown. But that's what makes it sound so rocking.
Yeah. Yeah, it's badass.
On Valentine's Day, so happy Valentine's, 1963, the Coca-Cola Company introduced its first low-calorie soft drink, Tab.
Oh, the preferred beverage of chain-smoking ants across the country.
And they test-marketed it in Springfield, Massachusetts.
On the 17th of February, 1963, Michael Jordan was born. The famous basketball player, not to be confused with Michael B. Jordan, who wound up playing not one, but two famous Marvel characters in the movies. Can you name them?
I believe one would be the Human Torch.
Yes, in the last Fantastic Four movie.
The last less than Fantastic Four movie.
Yeah.
But that is...
You actually got the obscure one. The better known one was Killmonger from the Black Panther movie.
Yeah, yeah, now that totally clicks.
Yep. So like Chris Evans, he was an actor who played the Human Torch and then went on to play a much better character in a Marvel
Save
Cinematic
his
Universe
career.
Movie. Yeah. Yep. And then also born in February 1963, on the 22nd, Pebbles Flintstone was born in an episode of The Flintstones called The Blessed Event. So that's everything that happened in February 1963. Nothing else happened.
It's everything that we know of.
Yes. Everything that jumped out at us as something worth mentioning. So this is why we're podcasters about comic books and not history teachers.
We'll be right back.
So let's go ahead and do some brief issue recaps of the five comic book stories that we are talking about this month. I will lead off and talk about what happened in Fantastic Four number 13, which I'm just going to say this. If you only read one issue this month, this would be the one to read. It's not a super eventful month either in history or in Marvel Comics, but this is actually a pretty pivotal issue for a number of reasons. The story is called The Fantastic Four versus the Red Ghost and His Indescribable Super Apes, which I will now attempt to describe.
Good luck.
Ivan Kragov is a Soviet scientist who is training three apes. A gorilla, a baboon, and an orangutan for a mission to the moon. And he's using a new fuel that he made from a meteor that crash-landed in the Soviet Union several years ago. In a bizarre coincidence, Reed Richards is working on the exact same formula from a different meteor that crash-landed in the United States. Again, playing off of all the space race, Cold War paranoia, the greatest heroes of the U.S. and the Soviet Union rushing to get to the moon first. Remember, we wouldn't actually get to the moon for another 6 years, 7 years later. So not only is the race to the moon on everyone's mind, but no one had really any idea what exactly we would find once we got there. So it's still very fertile ground for storytelling, especially in science fiction. So Kragov has designed his ship to be totally unshielded against cosmic rays intentionally because he wants to give him and his apes powers like the Fantastic Four gained. And it works. So as they are flying through the cosmic radiation belt, the gorilla winds up getting super strength. The baboon gains the ability to change its shape into a copy of anything. The orangutan gets magnetic powers. And Kragov himself becomes the Red Ghost, who has the power to become intangible. By the way, red refers to Kragov's political affiliations. it is not the color of the character or his outfit. He's a commie in a green jumpsuit.
I feel like they could have just given him a red jumpsuit and tied it together, you know?
You know, honestly, I was wondering why they didn't. And just to go off on a quick tangent, I heard a theory on this, which is basically that, especially in early superhero comics, primary colors were meant to indicate heroism, and secondary colors and tertiary colors were villainous. So that's the reason why, like, you know, Spider-Man is red and blue, and the Fantastic Four are in blue outfits, mm-hmm. And Ant-Man's in, you know, red and blue. But then you also have the Hulk, who's very in between, who's gray
and even
purple.
Yeah. Thing is orange,
thing
which is
orange.
In between.
Yep, yeah. Yep, exactly. And so I think maybe the reason that they dressed Kragov in green was to indicate this sort of, you know, villainous nature. So Fantastic Four and Kragov and his apes are flying toward the moon. They have a skirmish in space. And after that, the Fantastic Four lands on the mysterious blue area of the moon, which has the remains of an ancient, long-dead civilization. The Thing decides to go out for a walk. He's quickly ambushed by the Red Ghost and his apes, but a mysterious being called the Watcher intervenes. And this is the first time we see the Watcher, who winds up being a pretty major character in Marvel Comics. To describe him, he's a huge, very strange-looking dude in a toga with a giant head and glowing eyes. He lives on the moon. He's part of a race that observes different civilizations across the galaxy. And he lays down the law with the Thing and Kragov and the Super Apes. He refuses to let the conflict of the Cold War spread to the moon. He says he's seen all this before and it's not going to happen here. So he says the Fantastic Four and the Red Ghost are going to have to represent each of their respective sides, and only they will decide who is the ultimate victor in this conflict. The Watcher transports them to an enormous dead city, and the battle is on. The Red Ghost and his apes get the upper hand on the FF. They kidnap Sue Storm, who escapes by freeing the apes, and she winds up giving them access to the food that the Red Ghost was keeping from them. So The ghost has been starving the apes. He's been mistreating the apes. He's been kind of brutalizing them so that they will be his servants. And when Sue lets them go, it kind of breaks that. The red ghost phases into the Watcher's home. He tries to steal some of the Watcher's secrets to use against the Fantastic Four and against the Western world in general. But he quickly gets completely overwhelmed by how alien and otherworldly it is. The Watcher shows up, kicks the red ghost out of his home. The Fantastic Four paralyzes him with a ray that Reed whipped up. And the Watcher declares the Fantastic Four the victors. Hooray! The apes free the Red Ghost from his paralysis, but they refuse to follow his orders any longer. And they chase him away, and he's got to go deal with that now. The Fantastic Four head home with their fancy new rocket fuel, which Reed presents to the National Space Agency. And that wraps up this issue of Fantastic Four.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff in there that we will revisit in a little bit when we talk about what mattered.
But, it's a convoluted story, but that's the through line.
Yeah, that is the straight description of what happened.
Yeah,
dear listeners, loyal legion of listeners. I just wanted to do a Stanley
nice alliteration.
There. Yeah. Well, I will take us one step off of the Fantastic Four to another Human Torch solo adventure, sort of.
The mediocre one.
And in Strange Tales number 107, this issue does at least have the Submariner.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
But it is the Submariner written by Larry Lieber. So let's see what happens.
Okay.
This is called the Master of Flame versus the Monarch of the Sea. So Johnny Storm returns home from school to find that the rest of the FF has been meeting without him. he's tired of being treated like a kid, which he is, and decides to challenge and defeat the Submariner to prove himself. So he has the great idea of going to fight the Submariner by himself to prove that he's not a kid who doesn't think things through.
Now, the Submariner also has held his own against the entire Fantastic Four prior to this several times. But Johnny gets it into his head that he's just going to he's going to be the one to bring him down solo.
Yep.
Okay.
So Johnny hitches a ride on a sailing ship where he's accused of being a stowaway and forced to swab the deck. After helping them navigate a foggy night, he flame writes a challenge to Namor in the sky in reverse so that Namor can read it from under the waves.
Yeah, no, it's really an impressive technique.
And keeping those flame, I don't even want to go into flame writing. A flying fish gets too close to the letters, singes itself, and then it returns to Namor. Because the sea is a small neighborhood.
Apparently.
Namor decides to investigate and sees the torch's challenge. So Namor, you know, basically tries to say, okay, little guy, just go home. And also Namor really likes, you know, Johnny's sister.
Right.
So he doesn't want to get in a big scrap with him.
Yeah. This actually is one of the most heroic things that Namor does this early on in his career is just being like, kid, you're out of your depth. Go home. Right.
You're out of your element, Donnie. Namor weirdly hypnotizes the torch with an ancient idol that he finds and punches him with an asbestos glove that he also finds in the sea. Then he ties him to a dolphin and sends him on his way. So it's pretty funny.
Yep.
But the torch frees himself carefully. He doesn't burn the dolphin.
Yes, he takes a lot of care. Animal lovers, so don't worry.
And then he chases after Namor with his supernova intensity, which we should say isn't physically, you know, in the realm of physics, a supernova intensity, but it's a very hot flame he makes. So
right.
It is so hot that he can tunnel underwater. So he just don't try to wrap your brains around it too much. The torch traps Namor in an underground cavern, hitches a ride back to shore with his sailor friends, which he runs into again.
Yes.
Namor,
because the sea is a small neighborhood.
Again, it's a small neighborhood.
Yeah.
Namor frees himself and grudgingly gives the torch credit for being more powerful than he thought. He wonders if he could ever persuade him to join forces to defeat the Fantastic Four and conquer the world. And based on last issue of Strange Tales, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like Johnny will team up with anyone who fast talks him for more than a minute and a half.
And that's it, the end of Strange Tales.
Yeah, so it's sort of a non-decisive outcome, but honestly, turns out way better for the Torch than he has any right to expect.
He should have been drowned 400 times over.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. All right, well, I'm going to go with Tales to Astonish number 42, featuring the Ant-Man. This story is called The Voice of Doom, but don't get excited. It's not Dr. Doom. This story is about a soapbox preacher named Jason Cragg, who later on would be known as The Voice, but he doesn't get that that code name in this story. He sets himself up on a street corner, and he starts telling the crowd that Ant-Man is a sinister villain who must be driven from the city. And this hypnotic quality in his voice instantly turns the crowd against Ant-Man. So we flash back, and we learn that Craig used to be a radio announcer until he was exposed to, of course, radiation at a nearby atomic experimental laboratory, which gave him the power to bend others to his will. He winds up using this power to become a petty criminal. He sees Ant-Man defeat some crooks and decides that if he can just get rid of Ant-Man, then the city will be his. So, at a ceremony honoring Ant-Man for his service, Craig turns the nearby cops against Ant-Man, and before long, the entire city is trying to hunt Ant-Man down. During the chase, Ant-Man winds up losing his helmet, which was the defense that he had against Craig's voice. So Craig, now that he's able to command Ant-Man to do things, he forces him to reveal himself, and then he tells him to go and jump in the river and make no effort to keep himself from drowning, which is pretty ice cold, honestly. Yeah. Like, he could have just told him to leave town and never come back, right. But he's like, nope, get in the water.
Long walk drown off a short dock.
Yep. So Ant-Man does it, but his ants save him, and they don't even need to be ordered to do so. They do it because they love him and they're loyal to him.
Aww.
Aww. It's a touching story about a man and his ants. So Ant-Man returns to his home base. He concocts an elaborate plan that I am honestly just, I do not have the patience to get into here. Anyway, it all comes down into putting some laryngitis microbes on a microphone and then infecting Craig with them. He gets laryngitis instantly. Uh-huh. And it wrecks his voice permanently. Question mark. The end.
Yeah. On another odd note, I will take us on the journey into mystery. So number 91, this is Sandu, Master of the Supernatural.
Oh, yes, the legendary Sandu.
That you see so often in all of the movies and yes, hear so much about. never. So this is, it has a pretty cool cover with...
I guess we should mention this is a Thor story.
It is Thor. Yeah, yeah. We'll get to Thor. Thor getting a concrete building lowered over him as he's chained to the ground. So it looks like it could be cool.
Yeah.
Also,
it's got Loki's head.
It's got Loki's head.
Yeah.
So I'll read it. Okay, so quick synopsis. At the start of the story, Odin is holding on to Thor's belt of strength until the Thunder God has need of it. Guess what Thor will wind up wearing before the end of the issue? It's the belt.
It's the belt of strength.
Weird things are happening on Earth, like banks floating in the air and cash flying out of the till at a racetrack. It's the kind of thing that Thor instantly suspects Loki of being behind, but Odin confirms that Loki is still under house arrest in Asgard. But Loki has given his power to a carnival mystic named Sandu, who gets up to all sorts of trouble with it. Of course, petty crimes and floating banks. When Thor opposes him, Sandu drops a building on him, trapping him underneath it.
And then, if you gotta shut a guy up,
just put a building on him.
Yeah.
And that building had, I can't remember, but there were quite a few stories in this building. It was a sizable building.
Yeah.
So, you know, as a reader, you might think Thor is done for. But then you recall this belt of strength thing from the beginning.
Oh, which was so subtly teased.
And Odin sends the Valkyries to Earth with Thor's belt of strength. Surprise! And Thor frees himself. Sandu short circuits his enhanced powers by trying too hard to lift Thor's hammer, and he's arrested. The end.
What an epic tale.
There is not a lot of lame Dr. Blake in it. Nope. There's that.
So we got that going for us. And yeah, we do see Odin. We do see Loki. But we'll get into all that in a second. I am going to do the synopsis of our final issue that we're going to talk about today. Tales of Suspense number 40, featuring Iron Man in his second ever adventure. So the story opens with Tony Stark, the genius weapons manufacturer, trying to sell the army transistor-powered roller skates. I don't want to say this is why Vietnam didn't turn out the way that we wanted it to, but if we were gambling on transistor-powered roller skates to win, maybe we didn't have the best battle plan going into it.
They should have known that roads don't stay intact for moving troops with roller skates, but, whatever.
Also, I don't think transistors actually power anything.
Don't listen to
him.
Okay.
So he tries to sell transistor powered roller skates to the army. And then it cut to him playboying it up with some lovely society ladies. Of course, he can't take things any further with these lovely ladies because he has to wear his secret Iron Man chest piece under his clothes to keep his heart beating, or he will die. Very sad for rich playboy Tony Stark. But that doesn't stop him from taking a date to the circus. And during that visit to the circus, Stark winds up changing into Iron Man and capturing some escaped big cats when they threaten the crowd. Even though Iron Man saves her, Stark's date thinks that Iron Man is too scary. He resolves to paint his armor gold so it's not that weird gunmetal gray color, which, if you remember, the Hulk was that color when he started out, and that didn't reproduce super well in printing either. So we have a trend here of gray characters not being gray for more than one issue. So he exits his laboratory only to discover that the citizens of the city of Granville have suddenly and mysteriously erected a wall around it, and no one can enter or leave. So, of course, Iron Man, in his shiny new gold armor, heads to Granville and is immediately attacked by the citizens, who are worshipping a statue of a Neanderthal who they call Gargantus. Iron Man smashes the statue. He broadcasts a challenge to Gargantus, who's a huge caveman with hypnotic eyes. It takes Iron Man about 6 panels to realize that Gargantus is a giant robot. He destroys him with magnets. He then reveals that an alien spaceship is hovering above the town inside of a dark cloud. He drives it off, liberating Granville and its citizens. And that is the end of Iron Man's second adventure. And that also wraps up all of the comics that we read this month. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about what actually mattered in all of these things. All right, Rob. So we read 5 stories this month. And let's take them from most relevant to the future of Marvel Comics to least. So do you want to lead us off? Which issue do you think had the most significant stuff?
Certainly, and almost always, whenever Fantastic Four is part of this, it's Fantastic Four.
Yeah, so, totally agreed.
Yeah, Fantastic Four number 13. Maybe not to the most significant, but it is the first appearance of Red Ghost and his super apes, mm-hmm. Which do happen to recur.
They do, yeah.
More importantly, I think, is the first appearance of the Watcher, which is also just sort of the herald of Cosmic Kirby time.
Yes.
And we will get into Cosmic Kirby as we proceed in these podcasts. But having the Watcher appear. We still don't know a lot about him, but we know about the non-interference. We know he's a giant bobblehead with a toga. We also have the first appearance of the blue area of the moon.
Mm-hmm.
So it later figures into a number of major stories, including the Inhumans, the Kree-Skrull War, the Dark Phoenix Saga, and the Destiny War.
Yeah, whenever a Marvel characters go to the moon, they almost inevitably wind up hitting the blue area or like passing by it or referencing it or something. This is like, it's a total landmark. Like it's a, it is a really important geographic area mm-hmm. that just winds up figuring into all sorts of space stories.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's super important.
And then I guess finally, we have Ditko inking over Kirby's pencils.
Yeah, and that's a really unusual. I think the only other time we've seen that was in the Hulk story a few months ago. Yeah.
And it has some stylistically odd things, and mm-hmm. it has some stylistically interesting things. I think when he's doing a lot of color wash and landscapes, mm-hmm. it's really interesting. When he's doing close-ups of people, it's just weird and kind of off.
Yeah, because you have two guys who have really, really, really strong styles, and they're totally incompatible styles too. Yeah. You know, like it's. I think like the landscape stuff is great. You know, like the environmental stuff is great, but like Ditko's idea of what action should look like versus what Kirby's idea of what action should look like are just, they're not on the same page. So it's, but also like, it's just, it's a really interesting thing to look at, you know, just like that creative tension, even when it doesn't work, it's like, yeah, there's, it's, it, when it's bad in a totally unique way.
Yeah. And it's still a great comic. It's not
totally. Yeah.
And it's just compared to the others that we've read and seen. You can see what is different, and there's all kinds. There's weird stuff in here. There's a baboon that changes into a gun.
Yeah,
and so seeing that, and seeing that with how Ditko interprets, you know, and inks, it's just weird.
Yeah,
And that's usually one of the words we use to describe Ditko.
But, yeah, no, totally. Yeah. I mean, he's great, and he's. Both he and Kirby, neither one really portrays the world in a objectively realistic way. But I think when, you know, you mash up their two styles, even when it doesn't work, it's still interesting to look at.
Yeah.
I really recommend that, you know, anyone who's curious about this should just flip through Fantastic Four number 13 if you get the chance, because it's just, it's an utterly unique thing. Like there's nothing else that we've read so far, I think, that looks like this.
Yeah. And I think I still speaking in comic book 1960s comic book style,
mm-hmm.
Kirby tends to do some things that are hyper real, like big force perspective and
yes,
a lot of action. And the way Ditko approaches when he pencils, like on Spider-Man, it's more surreal.
Yes.
It is more dreamlike and odd. Mm-hmm. And so when they combine it, you could guess that it does some weird things.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's still, it's interesting. It's worth a look.
Yep. Totally.
Okay. What else you got?
Fantastic Four number 13. Absolutely. That is far and away. That is maybe the one issue that really matters from this month. Mm-hmm. If you're going to read two stories from this month, I would say Tales of Suspense number 40, the Iron Man story. So Gargantus is a totally forgettable villain, never shows up again, turned out to just be, you know, a big caveman robot anyway, and is destroyed by the end of it. The aliens that created him never show up again. So, you know, it's not like we're establishing any future foes of Iron Man or anything like that. There are a couple core elements of Iron Man lore that are added in this short story. The first is that Iron Man's armor goes gold. This is supposedly at Stan Lee's request. As the story goes, he didn't like the gray version of Iron Man, even though, you know, having a character called Iron Man, you know, be gray does make sense. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't visually interesting to Stan, apparently. So he said, let's write into the story that he decides to paint his armor gold. But this also, this sets up the idea that Tony Stark's armor is going to evolve over time. Mm-hmm. So this is the second version of the Iron Man armor. And, you know, over the years, he winds up creating dozens and dozens. So, you know, that whole idea of, hey, don't get too used to Iron Man's look because he's going to change it up constantly. The second thing is the chest plate. So it's the first time that we see that Stark wears the chest piece under his clothing at all times, and he needs to keep it charged up to keep his heart beating. And this winds up being a major aspect of the character in the early days. You know, again, every solo character in Marvel Comics at this point, and other publishers, needs to have a secret identity, needs to have a weird weakness. Mm-hmm. And so this is, you know, Iron Man. He can't let anyone know he's Iron Man, and he needs to have this heart condition, and the chest plate being charged is his kryptonite. So I think those two things, if you want to take anything away from that story, those are the two major things.
I think they're the minor things that are also in the story. Mm-hmm. It's just that it's the second time we've seen Iron Man. We see more about Playboy Tony Stark. We totally, see more yeah. about mm-hmm. his relationship with, you know, America mm-hmm. and supporting our troops. So in this time and in this era, it's not such a weird thing. It's more patriotic that he is a arms dealer
right.
Working with the U.S. You know, he is trying to stop communism,
yep.
stop the Soviets, just like everyone else in America.
Yeah.
So he seems more patriotic because he does that.
Yeah.
Whereas that's painted a little differently as we head towards, you know, our era where we see him in the movies and some of, you know, what he does there.
Yeah, totally. I remember when the first Iron Man movie came out, I thought the most impressive thing they did in that movie was to have a movie come out where the hero was an arms dealer. Mm-hmm. And you have that come out while we were still very actively involved in Iraq and Afghanistan. And regardless of how you felt about those wars and America's foreign policy in general, they managed to somehow thread the needle so that you saw Tony Stark as the hero, which is, that's an impressive feat.
Yeah. And I think they did a great job of taking the amalgam of Tony from over the years yeah. too, and making him this likable but hateable character at the same time. Like, he is a genius who is super self-confident mm-hmm. and overbearing.
Yep.
And they paint him and they, you know, they cast him well, and that made him more interesting, honestly, yep. from reading decades of Iron Man comic books. I was really impressed with how they did that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I've been reading the Marvel Epic collections, and I've just read a couple volumes of Iron Man, and there's some bad stretches of Iron Man ahead
of
us.
Yeah.
But there's also some very good ones. I wound up reading a collection that has, you know, the first couple years of Iron Man stories. I was surprised at how quickly Iron Man becomes actually a really good comic, mm-hmm. and what a high level it stays at for a good chunk of time. So
it has its ups and downs, but even then it has some great writers and or artists that flow through during that. So sometimes they're just not the best pair.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
We also see a lot of the, you know, utility belt nature of the Iron Man armor. So he does a lot of, you know, he does some flying, he does some public announcement, he does some drilling with his fingers.
Yep.
You know, so you can see he's got gadgets, and that's another very important part of the character.
Totally. And the armor is collapsible. He has it in his briefcase at the circus, and he like unfolds it all and like puts it on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which makes way more sense now than it did then. Yeah. But, you know,
it looks like he's just unfolding like aluminum foil that's been stepped on.
Yes.
Like, I'm going to put on my special armor.
Yeah. And then I'm going to look like a battleship somehow. Yeah. Okay. Whatever, Tony, you're a genius. All right, cool. Well, now we're kind of getting into the struggling to find things to say portion of the show. But so I'll go, if I'm going to rank a third place one, honestly, I think all the rest of the stories kind of tie for third. But mm-hmm. I'm just going to go with Strange Tales 107, The Submariner, and Human Torch. So I think there's a couple of things here that are worth mentioning. First of all, it's a Submariner versus Human Torch story in the Silver Age. In the Golden Age, Namor has been a character since like the 1940s. Mm-hmm. In the Golden Age, he fought the original Human Torch. Sometimes he teamed up with the original Human Torch. But this is the first time we've seen like a one-on-one fight between Namor and the Johnny Storm Human Torch. And there's no explicit callback to it, but the cover definitely evokes it. It's kind of cool to see, like, from a historical perspective, that they're putting these two characters together, even if the story itself is nothing super special.
Right.
The other thing about it is that it's the last time that Namor demonstrates that he has fish powers.
Oh, God. So, and they are so ridiculous in this.
Yeah. So basically, like in the story, Submariner, he mimics the abilities of different marine animals. And he did this in the issue of Fantastic Four, where he teamed up with Dr. Doom. Like yeah. he sent electricity back by channeling the power of an electric eel or something like mm-hmm. that. But with this one, like Johnny Storm, like crashes him into a coral reef, and he survives it by blowing himself up like a puffer fish.
It's an iceberg. He escapes
from iceberg. Yeah. Sorry. Thank you for that correction.
I didn't want to get a no prize.
No.
On this.
Yeah. Exactly. I don't want to get added. but yeah. So yeah, Johnny runs him into an iceberg, and he crashes into it, inflated like a puffer fish, so he can deflate himself and crawl out of the crater that he made. And Namor as a puffer fish almost was my panel of the month, but I'm like, I don't even want to dignify this with the
it's also weird because Namor is drawn by Dick Ayers in this whole issue is Dick Ayers drawn.
Yes,
so
yeah.
mm-hmm. It's just a much more cartoony style.
Yeah, it actually is like a really simplified Golden Age style of Namor too. Like the cover mm-hmm. of the two of them, it looks like right out of like 1940s comics.
Yeah,
but it's like really clean, simple line work. Mm-hmm. It's a real straightforward story. Guy wants to beat up guy, and they beat each other up for a while. So, you know, not a lot of meat on that bone.
There's also that throwback of it's really odd Namor's voice, the voice of his character
yeah.
is very different than what Stan has established. This is Larry writing Namor, but it's more of a "Hey pal, get out of here" kind of talk, and not the imperious
don't
Rex.
Be a wise guy. Yeah. See,
yeah,
yeah.
He says all kinds of. I mean, I was. He does say, "Come here, old pal. I have a job for you." When he's talking to a dolphin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's just not the way Namor has talked so far. So
no, he sounds really young and. More impetuous than Imperious Rex.
And just like some normal guy from New York.
Yeah,
not
yeah.
just not the Prince of Atlantis.
No, his regal demeanor is totally gone. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess now that we're scraping around the bottom of the barrel, let's talk about Journey into Mystery.
Okay.
So Journey into Mystery number 91, the things that mattered are short. We have a bit more Asgardian lore.
Mm-hmm.
We have the Valkyries. We have Thor's Belt of Strength, which I can't even pronounce. And I have a lot of Scandinavian background. Megingjord.
Sure.
Sorry, everyone who speaks languages that we don't.
I've checked our stats, and we have like less than 1% of our listeners are from Europe. So okay. I think we're okay.
So far, so good. Someday they'll be looking at the back catalog, and then we will get added. So it's not a lot of detail about either of them, but it's just establishing more. It's just more Asgardian stuff, which is awesome.
We're starting to pull a few more things from the actual mythology into the character, which, man, the more of that we get in there and the less of lame Dr. Blake we get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, we really are. We've said a lot of lame Dr. Blake, and, you know, we're going to have to do something about it sometime.
Yes, I believe you're correct.
And then not that it mattered, we have Sandu, the throwaway villain that never appears again that got blessed with some crazy powers from Loki for a day.
Yep.
And put a building on Thor. I mean, I picture him like in the bar with no name or just jail saying, "I threw a building onto Thor." And everyone's like, "Get out of here, Sandu."
Yeah. Sandu, you're cut off. No, he's like the Miracle Man Redux.
Yeah.
Like just, you know, some guy who shows up with, you know, briefly has enough power to put up a challenge and then is never heard from again.
Yep.
Well, cool. Well, oh, man.
That leaves us at the bottom of the barrel.
That means I have to talk about Ant-Man. Okay. Tales of Astonish number 42. Here's the one thing I can say that mattered about this issue. It was the first appearance of The Voice. So Jason Craig, he did show up a few more times as a villain, as The Voice. He winds up taking on the West Coast Avengers. So you know, it's going to be another 15 years before we have to think about him again. He fights Hank Pym after Hank, or I want to say after Hank Pym stopped being a superhero, but he stops being a superhero a lot, and then he resumes doing it. But when he is in his guise as Hank Pym adventurer and support player for the Avengers, and not a an Ant-Man or a Giant Man or a Yellow Jacket,
like
a
lab assistant, right? Hank Pym. Yeah,
I think it's in his red jumpsuit days. Yeah. So, yeah. But other than that, really nothing to remember about that issue. In fact, I'm not sure anyone does remember anything about it.
Yeah, so. Insane. I certainly didn't recall that at all. Yeah. And it said Voice of Doom, and yes, you get a, you assume that there's going to be a Doctor of Doom involved. But
I mean, those four letters mean something in the Marvel Universe. Yeah, it's already, like one very specific thing.
But no, it's just Mr. Doom.
Yeah.
I don't even know if dignifying him with Mr. is nice. And, you know, he is also, I don't know why I'm so obsessed with this, but he's not even a good radio announcer. They say he's like a mediocre radio announcer who's about to lose his job when he gets this, you know, radioactive isotope that magically makes his voice hypnotic.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah, it's just... He's just garbage person.
Yes, exactly. And then, like, immediately uses it to become a petty criminal.
Right. Yeah, and decides to go up against the Ant-Man because, you know, start low.
Yeah.
Pun intended.
Yeah. Although I have to give him credit, he did try to drown him. So, yeah, you know.
That was pretty villain.
Yeah.
Well, that brings us to the panel of the month.
Panel of the month. Let's bring this all home. I'm going to go ahead and say I think my panel of the month is from Fantastic Four. So we talked a lot about how the sort of clash of styles of Kirby and Ditko really, for a lot of the issue, didn't work. I think one place it really did work was on page 9, panel 4. This is the first glimpse we get of the blue area of the moon. And... the way it's drawn, the way it's colored, it has this really creepy sense of desolation. Mm-hmm. And there's it's very detailed, it's very complex. It really it gives you the sense that there was a thriving culture here at one point, and it has been utterly eradicated for centuries. And I think this really plays to both artists' strengths, where, mm-hmm. You know, this is them both having a chance to really be broad and surreal. And I think that's two things that both Kirby and Ditko excelled at, not necessarily in the same way, but when you let two guys like that just kind of go nuts and, you know, just put down on paper what's in their head, I think you get some really interesting results. I think this is a really great panel, and that might be part of the reason why the blue area winds up being such an important place in Marvel Comics going forward, is just that the first impression you get is really striking.
Yeah, so. It's weird because it's with the Kirby style that it's like an ink painting almost, where it evokes this huge amount of detail, but there really is not a ton of ink on there. You know, like it's not like he's drawn a super detailed brick building or something.
Right.
It's how he's chosen to make dark and light spots, but the ship coming in is super clean and super sci-fi. And then that really helps to show that the degradation of this civilization, and the colors are just green, blue, and purple.
Yeah,
that are weirdly melded together to make to paint that picture. So it's a great panel.
Yeah,
it's hard to top that panel.
Yeah, it feels really creepy and really alien, and I love it. What panel did you pick for your panel of the month?
Well, I am just a few pages ahead of that.
Uh-huh.
In the same issue, Fantastic Four number 13. Page 6, panel 1. So this is just the gang looking out the porthole as they spot the Soviet ship.
Mm.
Sue's pointing at it. And mainly it's just that it's just this nice little stark image with the circle with them all in it, and you can see the detail of the inside of the ship, but you also see Ben just floating upside down, and he's saying, they're like, look out off in the distance, there's another spaceship, and he's like, got no time to look at anything now, I'm enjoying this free fall. Wee, it's like floating on a cloud. And it's just and the way his head is tilted and his hand is out, it just looks like he's floating in zero G and he's having a ball.
Yep.
And so that to me, it just makes him also a more likable character in this one little moment when everyone's super serious, they're in space, and he's just like enjoying floating around.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it's more about the character building of that shot, because there is some weirdness in the Ditko inking here, just of how the faces look in close up, and but the detail in the background of the Kirby ship interior is classic Kirby.
Yeah, totally. No, it's a great, great image. So this is a 5-part story, and every one of them has like this 2/3 splash page.
Yeah.
Every part does. And they're all golden. But I think those are the two strongest ones that stand right out. And compared to everything else, like, honestly, I like thinking about the other stories that we read, there's not anything that jumps out at me where I'm thinking it's like, oh, that was a really striking image that month, you know?
No.
But again, so Fantastic Four was the only issue that Ditko touched, and it's only one of two issues that Kirby touched. So, nothing against everyone else who worked on stories this month, but like Joe Sinnott did Journey into Mystery, and he actually winds up being my very favorite Kirby anchor down the road. But, you know, nothing super, you know, memorable about that story or, you know, how it was done. The Strange Tales story, the Dick Ayers pencils and inks, I think it was great in that really clean line style and things like that, and like evoking the golden age-ness of the characters. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, nothing that really kind of, you know, lit my fire. Kirby penciled and Don Heck inked the Iron Man story, which is pretty cool.
I kind of wish Don got to continue penciling, you know, but he penciled the forgettable Voice of Doom.
Yeah.
the Ant-Man story.
Yeah.
And that one was nothing as good as what we saw in that first issue of Iron Man and Tales, or Tales of Suspense number 39.
Yeah. Well, and the good news for Don Heck is that he does get a lot of much more interesting stuff to do. He basically becomes a regular Iron Man artist going forward. Then he winds up penciling a little book called The Avengers. Never heard of him. Yeah. You should check him out sometime. And we will check him out in about 6-7 issues or episodes from now. I think that wraps it up for this month. So that's April 1963 in the books. I will just end now by letting folks know where they can find us on the internet. And that would be www.marvelbythemonth.com. You can also email us at marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. You can find all of our social stuff on the website, but definitely check out Instagram at Marvel by the Month. We post stuff just about every day now, so we're really digging it, and hopefully you will too. So I think that's it. Anything else you want to throw in?
No, that is it for this week.
Cool. Well, thanks again for listening. We'll be back at you next week, hopefully with some more exciting stuff. Actually, it will be the debut of a new series next week, so just tune in for that, if nothing else. Until then, I shall remain Brian Stratton.
And I can remain Rob Milne.
We will see you next week for next month.